Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Margaret Wertheim, a science writer who has written for The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, The Guardian, and Wired. She's the author of Pythagoras' Trousers, A History of the Relationship Between Physics and Religion, and The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, A History of Space from Dante to the Internet. In her work pioneering new methods of science communication, she founded the nonprofit Institute for Figuring, through which she's created the Hyperbolic Crochet Coral Reef Project, which is now the largest participatory art science project in the world. Her latest book is Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. Welcome to Background Briefing, Margaret Wertheim.
It's an honor to be here.
And as I mentioned in the opening, you're being drawn to these outsider physicists, these fringe theorists who probe the cosmos in their own way. And since all great truths begin as blasphemy, as Galileo learned the hard way, they might just end up being proven right. What are the chances?
Well, I suppose that depends what you mean by the word right.
I see. But isn't science exact?
Well, that's what a lot of people think the criteria for judging scientific theories is, and in many ways it is. I mean, there's no question that the exactitude of physics has given us microchips because we know about the quantum understanding of matter. Electromagnetism has given us, electricity running to our homes. So there's this huge instrumental part of science which relies on exactitude and very, very precise understanding of things. But there's another part of science, which is really what my book is about, and it's what I call the cosmological function of science. As one great chaos theorist put it, part of the function of science is to help us to feel at home in the universe. And so partly what my book is about is who gets to feel at home in the universe that contemporary theoretical physics describes. So if you look at, our contemporary cosmological understanding of the world is in terms of general relativity and quantum mechanics. But those theories are incredibly difficult to understand. They're couched in this very arcane language, very, very highly developed mathematics, which almost nobody can understand. And so the people that I write about in my book, what I call outsider theorists or fringe physicists, they reject this really kind of academic mathematical understanding of the universe, and their claim, whatever we think of it, but their claim is that nature speaks a language that the ordinary person can and should be able to understand.
So does that mean then that observation experimentation is out? I mean, that's how it's lasted forever. I mean, it's funny that you should write this book at a very moment where in the political world, on the right wing, there's a jihad against science by the fundamentalists and by the Koch brothers and others against climate science. Mm. And in a curious way, on the left, here at this radio station, there's a lot of sort of new age health and spirituality stuff that justifies itself by attacking science and by attacking modern medicine. So you've got the Koch brothers attacking science in order to sell their oil. And you've got the New Ages attacking science to sell snake oil. Mm. So here you come along and open the door for them.
Yes. I mean, it's very interesting that the book has appeared in this moment. And for all the reasons that you've just said, Ian, I mean, I kind of feel a bit flabbergasted myself because I first started, thinking about this book 18 years ago when I met the man who's the hero of my book, a guy called Jim Carter, who has this complete alternative theory of the universe that he's actually now been working on for 50 years, and he has a complete alternative to general relativity and quantum mechanics and the creation of the universe, and this is all dreamed up in his backyard in Enumclaw, Washington, where he makes giant smoke rings to test his theories. And I'd like to sort of start off by saying, I don't believe that Jim or any of the outsider physicists that I've ever met are going to win the Nobel Prize, nor do I believe that they're ever going to be taught in Harvard or Princeton or Stanford, and nor do I think they should be. What I'm interested in here is two things, is the sociological phenomena of why are these people doing it? At a moment in history when there's so much amazing speculative physics coming out of universities, things like hyperspace theory and string theory. Brian Greene's, you know, new series on string theories is airing on Nova at the moment. Why is anyone in a trailer park feeling moved to have his own theory of the universe, to rebuild physics from the ground up for himself? I've been thinking about this subject for almost 20 years. And it's funny that the book's just come out at this moment when there is, as it were, so much on as you say, both the right and the left, as it were, resistance to science. My book comes from a love of science. I'm a science writer. I've devoted my life to trying to make physics accessible to the general public. So I became completely fascinated. What do these people tell us about our society's relationship to physics?
And this extraordinary fellow whose work is so beautiful. I mean, you're going to be exhibiting it soon, right, in a gallery, because it looks extraordinary just in the pictures that you have in the book. He starts out as an abalone diver on Catalina Island, right? And then he's a gold miner first, and then an abalone diver. That's why I was playing the Heart.
Yes, I've been the Neil Young song. Yeah,
a
exactly.
Miner for a Heart of Gold.
Beautiful. Yes.
So tell me about this man's journey towards an alternative theory of the universe. We're not saying he's qualified. I mean, but Michael Faraday wasn't qualified neither.
Jim is a theoretical physicist. That's what he claims to be. And he comes at it from, he spent his life doing things. First of all, he was a gold miner in his early 20s, and then he became an abalone diver out on Catalina Island. And then he actually invented, he made an actual engineering invention. He invented something called lift bags, which is a very simple invention. You use Archimedes' principle. If you want to lift something from under the sea, you can take a bag under the water, inflate it with air, and presto, it lifts the boat up. And he was the first person to actually have these on the market. And so he's now got a successful little company making these things that lift sunken boats all over the world. And while he's been doing this, he's been developing his own theory of physics. And what's driven him is the belief that the universe is like a machine. And he, who's a great mechanic, he's a great natural mechanic, that because he feels like he can fix and repair any machine, he feels like he can, as it were, understand the cosmic machine. And he wants to feel at home in the universe, and he loves science and believes in it and believes it is the right language to describe the ultimate nature of reality. But he believes and insists the ultimate nature of reality should be available and accessible and satisfying to him. So like basically most insider physicists, he believes that science is the language of truth and of reality. And one of the things that I find fascinating about Jim and these other outsider physicists like him is that they, unlike creationists, they actually believe science is the ultimate language, but they resist, as it were, what they feel is the elitism of academic science. And the aim of my book is not to, as it were, endorse that principle, but to actually ask the sociological question, why is this going on? And one of the things, reasons why I personally think it matters that we discuss this, is because I think that we do have a lot of resistance to science in our society in a very negative way. But I think part of it is because there is a way in which science has become quite alienating to many people. And I think it's not clear what we do about that, but I think it's a social issue that we really need to look at. How can we, in some sense, make people how can we get people to see the value and beauty of science and not feel that is destructive in some sense to their necessary psychic structures?
Mm. Well, I think in many ways what happened to science, at least in the modern age, is that, as Niels Bohr said, you know, there are no secrets in nature, only mysteries. But then he was grabbed from Denmark during World War II and sent to the Manhattan Project, and that was a massive secret undertaking. And I've spent an awful lot of time with some of the great physicists, Hans Bethe and Edward Teller, and their entire the great moments in their lives are the most classified secrets of all. There was just a report yesterday about the Iranians' efforts to get a bomb. So how much has secrecy made it esoteric? And how much have we drifted from Bohr's idea that there aren't any secrets, to nature, just mysteries?
Well, I mean, I think that's a beautiful comment of Bohr's. And Michael Faraday made a wonderful comment, which is quite famous. He said, "Nothing is too wonderful to be true." I think the problem at the moment, sociologically, as I see it, is not so much the secrecy issue, because usually the secrecy things are around scientific theories that might have military applications like atomic energy. But I think the real issue is what the people in my book are really reacting against is what they feel that the fundamental description of reality that we have is, which is being articulated through theories that are ever more mathematically arcane, like the mathematics of string theory, for instance, is just really incomprehensible to almost everybody. I mean, even most physicists can't understand string theory, if the truth be told. Most physicists will openly admit that to you. So if this is the fundamental nature of reality, the question is, should the fundamental nature of reality be accessible to ordinary people? And it introduces what I call the cosmological problem. What happens to a society if its official picture of reality becomes literally incomprehensible to its citizens?
Maybe that explains what's happening then.
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening.
Why people retreat into religion and into false certainties.
Yes, I mean, I think that's exactly what's happening is for a lot of people, they try to read books like string theory books or A Brief History of Time, and they can't understand it. So they think, science isn't for me, I'm either too dumb, I don't have that kind of a brain, or they think, as my people do, I don't accept that. I just don't accept that I can't understand nature. I do believe that nature is a comprehensible system. And what's happened, and I make this analogy in my book, and it's something that many of my subjects sort of have touched on, is that basically what they're claiming is something similar to what happened in the Reformation. Mm-hmm. You know, Martin Luther made the claim that all people should be able to read the Bible, the Book of God, in the vernacular language, and have a dialogue with God for themselves. It shouldn't be mediated through a Latin-speaking Catholic priesthood. So that was one of the great innovations of the Reformation, to say everyone can read the Book of God and, as it were, commune with God themselves. Now, the similar claim is effectively being made by these outsider theorists, these physics guys, that everybody should be able to read the Book of Nature for themselves and have a direct relationship with nature. It shouldn't have to be mediated through, as it were, an elite priesthood speaking this elite language, i.e. mathematics. Now, I don't see it as my job to adjudicate that claim. What I'm interested in is that the claim is being made, because I'm interested in the ways that science fits into the wider social and cultural landscape of our society. And I think that physics, which is, in theory, the way that we articulate reality, it is facing a problem. Almost nobody can understand string theory or even general relativity.
Mm. But what about Margaret Wertheim, again, the author of the new book, Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. One of the most beloved figures, of course, of science is Albert Einstein. And from my understanding is that he was actually quite accessible. And he wasn't esoteric. Because I remember a quote of his when von Neumann explained game theory to him. Einstein's reply was, "God is not mean; God is subtle." So, he of course has been proven correct, hasn't he? Maybe people couldn't understand his theories, but haven't they been proven correct? So,
oh, absolutely. I mean, Einstein general relativity has been tested to something like, 20 decimal places. General relativity makes predictions about the warping of space-time that affects light rays, and these corrections have to be taken into consideration when doing calculations on GPS satellites. So part of the reason that we can get GPS so perfectly and accurately is because there are corrections made for both special and general theories of relativity. The Einstein's theories literally work, and I accept them. I have a degree in physics, and I totally accept relativity. I believe in it completely. The people that I write about in my book do not accept it. They completely reject it as a theory of the universe. And it is difficult to understand relativity, particularly general relativity. It's 10-dimensional tensor equations. It is not easy stuff. And that is the problem, that people who don't have higher mathematical training feel, I don't understand that part, that description of the universe. I want an understanding of a description of the universe that is available to me. The difficulty, of course, is what do we do about the fact that the instrumentality of science is so successful? The fact that theory of relativity has actually helped to give us functioning GPS satellites. So it's a difficult place. Where do you draw the line about where you're, as it were, going to accept the scientific theories? And where does it grade into something that really is beyond empirical validation, which is where string theory is at the moment.
I understand, but isn't this is one of the things that offends me so much about the global warming deniers. And Rick Perry says it, that these scientists are just coming up with this alarmist stuff to raise funds for their research. And if anybody knows anything about any scientist, I've ever talked to a scientist, they're the most conservative people of all. They don't make rash claims. They're extremely judicious. Isn't that, it's a very, very disciplined, process, surely.
Oh, absolutely.
In other words, so what's this guy doing, blowing smoke rings and planting redwoods in circles? Just to give me an idea in the last minute or so here.
Well, he believes that he has found the true and final theory of the universe because he does really want to feel at home in the natural order. And he believes the natural order is something that he, as an ordinary human being, ought to be able to understand. Whether he's right about that claim or not, I think
we'll
not be able to know right now.
Time will tell. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Margaret Werther. Again, I've been speaking with Margaret Wertheim, who's a science writer, and she has written a new book, Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.